language engine master you know the Adisha Dikambashi Jana has said. So on his part he was you know, was the highest authority of practice of altruism or bodhicitta, and on the ordinary level he assumed the role of a great learned Indian pandit or scholar, but in definitive sense Adisha was you know, emanation of the Lord, the God of infinite light and the Tower. He has said on one occasion, our lives are very short, but the duration of our lives is extremely short, but they are countless objects of knowledge. Yet we do not know, know how long we will live in this world. It means that we do not have a definite idea of our remaining lifespan. We have no idea whether we will live for a long time or for a very short time, like one day and so on. We have no idea of our remaining lifespan. Therefore, like the goose, when it's given a mixture of milk and water, then in a short span of time, so it is able to distinguish, separate the milk from the water, and then drink the milk and leave the water behind. Therefore, if we were to try to master everything, every art and every science, there's no time because our life is too short. Therefore, try to master the choicest practice or the choicest thing. And according to, for him, the choicest, you know, the best thing was to practice the development of universal altruism, or the wish to achieve, the strong desire to achieve the state of enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Therefore, he said, don't waste time, but try hard to develop bodhicitta. And his father said, although you may contemplate hundreds of teachings of the great vehicle or the mind teachings, but all those contemplation of all those things boils down to or comes ultimately to the development and enhancement of bodhicitta. Therefore, without painstakingly contemplating hundreds of topics or hundreds of teachings, if you only contemplated bodhicitta, or if you only reflected on bodhicitta, so that ought to serve the purpose of reflecting on all those hundreds of topics. In the contemplation of one dharma, one practice of bodhicitta, all other contemplations of those topics would be, can be easily subsumed. Therefore, we all, the teacher and the taught, must all make effort in in developing this kind-heartedness, the highest form of kind-heartedness. That's because all the countless Buddhas of the past achieved the state of Buddhahood or enlightenment first by generating bodhicitta or the mind of enlightenment or universal altruism. And there are literally countless Buddhas in countless world systems in the universe, and all these Buddhas who are living now and teaching the fortunate beings in those countless world systems have also achieved their state of enlightenment through the development of bodhicitta. And all future Buddhas, meaning all sentient beings, the potential Buddhas of the future, are to achieve the state of enlightenment and must achieve enlightenment only through developing bodhicitta. Of course, bodhicitta must be accompanied by other practices. All those practices will not help a person achieve enlightenment unless those practices are based on or conjoined with bodhicitta. Therefore, no practice is as supreme and as wholesome as the practice of the development of bodhicitta. The Buddha Shakyamuni has himself said that bodhicitta is the path. Bodhicitta is the factor which reverses the path of the three lower realms of existence, a miserable existence, which means bodhicitta is one which helps one turn away from the path of the three lower realms of existence. And it's bodhicitta which shows the path of a happy existence temporarily in the human world and in the world of worldly gods. And then ultimately it's bodhicitta which shows the path to liberation and enlightenment. And it's this altruistic mind, universal altruistic mind, meaning that one's sense of bodhicitta, which will lead one or take one to the immortal state. Immortal state of Buddhahood where death, where rebirth, death and sicknesses are absolutely unknown, and where these unpleasant things have totally ceased. So it is bodhicitta which leads one to the peaceful immortal state. And it's quite lucky that we are studying Bodhicitta Avatara or engaging in the Bodhisattva's way of life, the text that we have studied on Monday classes. So that text is a very important, in fact, one of the most important texts which deal with instructions or methods of developing bodhicitta.
Non è che lo voglia venire, non è che sta subito, mi chiede se te, se tu hai immagini, ma te ne chiede, ma io non ho voglio più, ma te ne chiede.
And so besides that, we are also having classes on Thursdays. The Thursdays classes are classes are for the graduated path to enlightenment. And it is this text that Tribal itself describes. So it's all about, ultimately, it's all about bodhicitta and the mind practices. Lamman's path, Rinmin's stages of path enlightenment, and which is also called the graduated path enlightenment, is also called Sasangi Dhamma Jibu, means the only lamp, or the only torch, or the lamp in the two realms, in the two realms of worldly existence. And it's very all the teachings have been presented in the most orderly way, and so that the listeners of the teachings of the graduate path enlightenment can easily put the teachings into practice without having to put it without having to sort out the teachings and think about as to what he or she must practice. Teachings are already cooked in the in the graduated path enlightenment and ever ready to be practiced. Whereas other teachings like engaging in Bodhisattva's way of life and the treatise on the middle way and Prajnaparamita sutras, so on, although these are undoubtedly profound teachings, unless one is thoroughly well-versed or familiar with the Buddhist practice, one would find it difficult to at once readily put the teachings into practice. Dhamma, the famous disciple of Adisha in Tibet, so once asked his master Adisha, which is more important when it comes to practice, profound texts, treatises, or the instructions of the Guru? When it comes to practice, Adisha said, a Guru's instruction about practices are most important. Although one might be a great scholar who is able to mechanically, almost effortlessly talk about the great treatises in great length, but if that person lacks the enriching instructions of the from the Guru, then he won't be a great practitioner, only a great scholar, because his mind and the Dharma teachings will be separate, and his mind won't be able to absorb the teachings. Now, just as we have been talking about the six course and one result instruction or method of developing bodhicitta in our Thursday classes, and so far we have dealt with the first five courses, and the first was recognition of all sentient beings as our mothers, second one remembrance of kindness, third one repayment of kindness, and the fourth one affectionate love, and fifth one compassion, and so on. Now, today, in this class, would you please try to meditate on kindness of sentient beings when they have been our mothers, and when they have, even during our during the times when they have not been our mothers. And it's quite easy to understand how immensely sentient beings are kind to us. Right now, we have all the things that we need in life, but we get them, we've got them, not because we are so resourceful, we are so skillful and intelligent, the things we got them, independent of others' hard effort and work. So we got them entirely through other sentient beings. So imagine what we had when we just came out from mother's birth canal. We were just completely naked, empty-handed people. Right now we have everything almost we want. So we have them because of others' kindness. And that clearly shows that even when we wander from one stage of existence to the other, and before we achieve enlightenment, we depend entirely on sentient beings for our survival. Not only do we depend utterly, entirely on sentient beings for our survival, for our existence, when we achieve enlightenment, or we again depend on sentient beings, we have to achieve enlightenment through our practice, and practices are with respect to sentient beings. Without sentient beings, there would be no basis of a practice. And it's again sentient beings which provide us the indispensable basis for practice. And therefore, sentient beings are again extremely kind in helping us being the basis of our enlightening practice. Therefore, Shantideva said, when in achieving enlightenment both sentient beings and Buddhas are equally kind, you have a very biased attitude. When you think of Buddha, when you say Buddha, your eyebrows raise. You raise your eyebrows and you tend to have great faith and positive feelings towards Buddhas. And when it comes to dealing or seeing sentient beings, you tend to look down upon sentient beings and totally forget their kindnesses. Therefore, your attitude and your behavior are extremely prejudiced and not honest behaviors. When in fact both sentient beings and the Buddhas have been equally kind in helping one, teaching us, showing us the power of enlightenment, the other forming the basis of our power of enlightenment. Therefore, both are equally kind. Therefore, Father Shantideva says in the text that we will study in our Monday classes, he says that whenever you see sentient beings like an insect or like an ant or unpleasant, you know, people or person, you should not look with a frowning expression, but you should always have to look with affectionate love. Recalling, bringing home the point that if it's this particular sentient being on whom if our practice love, compassion, and so on, so these practices, enlightening practices, will achieve and ensure enlightenment to help a greater number of sentient beings. Therefore, regard that particular insect and or an ant or an unpleasant person as the jewel from which you achieve, you get in return the state of enlightenment. Therefore, instead of feeling, instead of having unkind feelings, you should be thankful and grateful, and thus respond or react in a very kind manner. A great Tibetan master has said, when the child, after being told to behave well, and it just misbehaves and then falls down and, you know, hurts himself or itself, then shows the anger and indignation to the kind mother, and the mother then, you know, doesn't bother, you know, that, you know, she looks after the child with love and kindness. In the same way, he says, although the sufferings of sentient beings are not created for them by someone else, but they were sufferings of sentient beings entirely because of their own misdeeds. And however, however, if we do not turn to you, O Lord Compassion Avalokiteshvara, who else shall we turn to and, you know, seek solace from our sufferings? He said, today, you know, people are passing through very difficult and hard times, and people, the farmers have lost their crops in the fields. And the nomads suffer from in a heavy loss of cattle's life, and due to some epidemic, so the cattle so die very on a large scale. And so the leaders and the authority, people on in the authority, so by being, by abusing their power, all that they do is they eliminate opposing and opponent, their opponents, and they keep on, being kind to their relatives and their party. And further is that many wars have broken out, epidemics have broken out, and natural catastrophes have taken a heavy toll of human lives and so on. And if we do not turn to you, O Lord, of compassion, to pacify these and to remove all these undesirable things from the surface of the world, who else should we turn for help and refuge? So just as he has prayed earnestly to Avalokiteshvara, so we should pray to him. In the meantime, we have to practice on repayment of all, excuse me, remembrance of the kindness of sentient beings. And now, please start the meditation on remembrance of their kindness. Now, by practicing the teachings that we receive, although we may not expect to become, great beings, highly accomplished beings as arhats in this lifetime, however, the benefits are tangible in that as we keep on applying the teachings in our daily life or live our lives by the teachings every day, that we begin to experience greater and greater ability to cope with all types of situations and circumstances. Although I have already taught you sharing letter to the friends or letter to the king by Nagarjuna, however, I would like to cite a verse from that word by Nagarjuna. In that he says, contentment is the real world. Otherwise, if we don't have sense of contentment or enoughness with a simple lot, then even though one may have the entire wealth of the world, one still would feel that one doesn't have enough, and that feeling that one still wants more or one doesn't have enough would torment one's happiness or torment one's mind. And therefore, the peerless leader, the Buddha Shakyamuni, has himself declared, he says, that contentment is the greatest virtue or the highest form of wealth a person can ever aspire. And because if we have sense of contentment, then we remain all the time quite happy, whatever our longings are, in both in quantity and quality. We always think that we have enough of everything that we need, and that keeps a person or us quite happy. That's because all that we seek in life is happiness and joy, and if that joy comes through, you know, through a matter of changing one's attitude, then it's worth having such happiness. To changing that attitude, thinking that one has enough and that keeping oneself quite happy. Therefore, in that letter to the king, Nagarjuna says, therefore, O great king, cultivate the virtue of contentment. And if you have a sense of contentment, you may not be really rich, but you are the richest person in the world. Deva means subdued king. The more, otherwise, if you are not developed mentally, the more wealth you have, the greater suffering you have correspondingly. In that, if you have much gold, silver, and other material things, then you have all the time great worries and anxiety, and anxiety or the worry of of not having enough, although one has a lot, and then the worries concerning how to have more gold or more things, and then the worries concerning as to how one should best safeguard and protect those things that one has painstakingly amassed, and then the constant worry that one might lose those things. As a result of these constant worries of getting more, safeguarding, and the fear of losing what one has acquired so far, so one will not have even a nice sound sleep. So what's the point of having all these if this all, if these material things have become the source of worry and anxiety? Therefore, O kings, cultivate the virtue of contentment, and those people who are happy with their simple lot, they don't have such worries and anxieties. And he gives an example of Naga kings, the kings of Nagas, or some kind of subterranean beings. And now he says, the supreme Nagas have many hats, and each hat has a jewel, heavy jewel, on top of it, and therefore, the more hat a supreme another has, the greater suffering he has to undergo of having to carry a huge weight on top of his neck. Therefore, similarly, the more wealth one has, if one doesn't have the ability to cope with one's wealth, if wealth only becomes source of suffering, then the more wealth one has, the greater suffering one will have. Chögyet means if you know the teachings or the Dharmic teachings of Dharma, then no, we won't have any difficulty in any situation. During the time of Buddha, there was a woman called Ma Sagama in Sarasvati, and she was a mother of 32 children. So she lived in the kingdom of King Salkil, and somehow all the 32 children were beheaded by the king. To inflict greater suffering on the woman, then he asked the ministers to pack up those 32 hats and ask them to send their hats in a box to Sagama, the lady. Buddha came to know of this, and because Buddha came to know that she was going to have immense difficult time ahead, and he advised the woman that she would receive a box, and he asked her to come to him before she opened the box. And when she reached the Buddha, then Buddha gave teachings on the Four Noble Truths. And there she gained many high realizations, and there she became an Arya, a female Arya, or a transcendental being. Buddha knew that if she would open the box before she got the teachings, then she would die of a heart attack there on the spot. Therefore, he advised him not to open the box before she had received the teachings. And then when Buddha knew that she had attained the state of Arya, or the status of transcendental practitioners or beings, and then Buddha asked her that she could open the box now. And naturally she found the 32 heads of her 32 children. Because she has she had attained the required realization to be able to cope with this that tragic situation, then she, instead of feeling miserable and fainting out of this tragedy, so she began to probe the karmic consequences behind such a massacre. Thus, if we are mentally developed through teachings, and when we are prepared to face any situation, then we like this woman Sagama, we won't have any difficult time to cope with all types of difficult situations, Instead, we are able to remain quite cool and maintain our sense of sanity. Because she wanted to know the karma behind such a tragedy, then she prostrated herself to the Buddha 2 times and then requested the Buddha to explain, you know, the cause behind such a tragedy. So Buddha said, in their last life, so 32 children had been 32 suffer thieves. King Sakyamuni in his last life was a lung means an ox. And as a result, what had happened was so those 32 thieves took the life of that ox for some reason, and because of that, the whole situation got reversed in the present lifetime. Then she asked what she had been in her last life. Buddha said, you had been the lady who gave her accommodation to those 32 thieves and allowed the ox to be killed, and you also partook the meat. And to such a connection in your last lives, so there you have such a situation in the present life. So chukitnetsu means literally the matters of teaching. But it all, in fact, means facts, inescapable facts about life. So if you know what the life is all about, life, precipitated or caused by actions and delusions, and then, when a person is prepared, the person is prepared enough to expect what in life, and life, he knows that life is not all that pleasant and rosy, and misfortunes always come every now and then, and these are taken as a natural part of life, and as a result, the person is able to maintain quite cool. And otherwise, if you do not understand that the realities concerning life, although one may be quite rich, but with a slight misfortune, then there are cases of people going to powerful and rich people not being able to cope with slight misfortune. Then they go to the extent of taking their own lives. I have only repeated what Nagarjuna has advised the king, and it is always useful to remember his advice. Kumbhalutu Arya Nagarjuna was such a highly accomplished, one of the highest authorities on Buddha's teachings, so much so that if we were to hear his name only, it is supposed to have a great significance, let alone being able to listen to his teachings and then apply the teachings in our lives. Now, for today's meditation, first I would like to give a small introduction, and there's a verse from a certain text which says, "Ningne Sanje Top Tenements." If you really want to be a Buddha, from the depths of your heart. And so you have to be with a compassionate master in order to receive teachings. Being with a compassionate master with total dedication to one's practice, and should also from the depths of one's heart. Means to practice the compassionate mind, practice the development of the supreme compassionate mind. Father Nagarjuna says, the moment a person has developed the supreme mind of compassion or the compassionate mind, then that person will achieve all the qualities up to the state of enlightenment. Therefore, who with an intelligent mind will not practice compassion, and who will deride and say underestimate the importance of compassion? Therefore, an intelligent person will always say. Place importance on compassion, and once he or she develops this sense of the great compassion, then all other practices will be a smooth practice.
No. 누가 되는 거 롱을 누가 봐 롱을 싸게 해봤다 뭐 하고 롱을 싸게 해봤다 당장 나와서 롱을 소식이 다 누나한테 내가 다시 몸을 더 요게 와서 하면 모자 유리게 소식이 누나한테 내가 내봐도 내가 이거 다시 넣어요 나와 다음 다 이제 이제 시작했으나 안에 그 생실 관계가 생길 통지를 누나한테 나눠서 싸게 해봐 그래 하고 다들 싸게 해 다시 또 싸게 해 그러나 이게 나 어떻게 됐습니다 몸을 먼저 말해 생실 통지를 누나한테 내가 다시 갔으니 그래서 또 내가 이거 이 답보 그래 한 이제 이제 내는 아니 생실 도무지 내시고 말이야 생체지 님네도 지 누저 지 마고 마이 니지에 나도 니지 맨들이 아니 콘트롤사님 그 누저 먹어 라네 그게 생 고제가 아니 동안에 세지 먹어 세 그래서 강남도 니지 맨신이라 와 니지 생기대 너무 내시 자지 생체 예로 내시 자지 오늘 나도 때문에 예 소소고 빼고 시험 때 니지 첨부 예나 빼 55 그만 겨와 그만 있다
So we all have to really think about compassion, not just you as a trainees. But all who are present here should make effort in developing great compassion. And once we develop great compassion, then all other practices will be successful practices. And now, the reason why, if we like great compassion through other teachings, through the practice of other teachings, we may achieve that state of. The state of the lesser vehicle, still we won't achieve the state of enlightenment. The reason why arhats of the lesser vehicle have the shortcoming of being in the state of nirvana only for themselves is because they do not have. Strong enough concern, motivated by great compassion for the suffering of other beings. That's why they are always enjoying the bliss of liberation or nirvana only for themselves. Now, whereas a person who has, like the bodhisattvas and so on, who have developed great compassion, so they understand that it is their responsibility, not so much sentient beings themselves, but it's their responsibility to remove the suffering and the causes of suffering of all suffering beings. So they take upon themselves. That is the duty to remove the suffering of all beings. And if we have compassion, then we really become a source of happiness for ourselves as well as for others. So much so that we won't even dare to harm a mosquito or a small insect. And so, otherwise, when we lack compassion, we lose our tempers quickly. And when we lose our tempers quickly, then we know what we actually do. We either say bad things and hurt others' feelings, or actually harm others by inflicting violence. And if we have compassion, all these unpleasant things, things that make our life and others' life unpleasant, unhappy all the time, will come to an end, and therefore we understand that compassion is the source of one's and others' happiness. Long, long ago, in ancient India, there was a king called Jambetta. His chief practice was to always practice compassion, and the king, instead of ruling the kingdom through secular things, secular means, he kept on practicing compassion. As a result, his compassion was able to give a total sense of security and happiness to all the subjects who lived in his kingdom. I have already given you how to instructions as to how to develop a sense of great compassion last Thursday. And when you practice compassion by visualizing those incidents or by reflecting on those teachings, what we have to see is you have to see that your mind itself transforms into compassion, not that you visualize compassion before you and then you focus your mind on the compassion. That's creating a space between compassion and one's mind. If that happens, the practice of compassion remains unsuccessful, whereas compassion has to, your mind itself has to grow into a compassion, it's a compassion mind, or has to be transformed into compassion. So please go ahead with that meditation on compassion. Changdu Lama Tsongkhapa Dapa Jerambo has said the following, and it's worth giving some thought to what he has said. At the moment, we have got this human life, which is like an excellent boat to go across the ocean of the great suffering of the world existence. However, we have become very unthoughtful of this human life, and as a result, we have got so distracted by worldly affairs, worldly things, such that we regard worldly riches or worldly things as the ultimate objective or ultimate aim in life. And in pursuit of worldly affairs or in worldly things, we have got completely distracted and thus become very unthoughtful of the value of human life. Without any sense of conscientiousness or some awareness of the value of human life, so we waste this human life by gossiping about different things, or the other, we become lazy and then fall asleep. In appearance, we are unquestionably human beings, but in terms of our thinking, mental process, we are not different from, you know, animals. Therefore, Manjushri, it's a time that you took pity on. Therefore, all material is time that you you took you know, pity on me. At another place, Jamgul Lama Tsongkhapa has said, at the moment we have got the superior and happy existence of humans, and if we don't develop by exercising human intellect and human mind, the wisdom to really probe into the vast teaching of the Buddha, And thus develop certain spiritual realization, it's quite possible that we may lose this human life and that we will, you know, we won't find this human life after death. Therefore, it's because it's quite possible that after this life, we may not come back as humans, but be reborn as miserable creatures or miserable beings of the two lower realms. This is the time when we should make most of this human life and to see that we secure some state of security from not falling into the two lower realms. He further says, just as I've advised you to do so, so do I practice the things myself. I, the yogi, do the same practice. I have done the same practice. Therefore, you should follow. It's worth listening to what I've told you. And in definitive sense, Jangu Lama Tsongkhapa was Manjushri himself. But in the eyes of ordinary people or wealthy people, so he appeared to be a great practitioner, a great scholar, who spent most of his time in intensive practice of gathering merits and purifying himself of any obstructive forces to achieve enlightenment. And after thorough purification and immense gathering of merits, he through his practice was able to achieve the state of Yuganada, which means state of enlightenment in that very life. Buddha has himself said, Jetur Sungpa Tao De Jeba means, I have acted strictly in accordance with the things that were advised or taught by my gurus. And Jetur Jeba Tao Sungpa means, I've taught you things that I've done strictly in accordance with my practice, or things I've taught you things which I have practiced myself. In fact, that should be the true quality of a master, one who practices things or teachings as you receive, he has received from his own masters, and who gives the teachings as he practices them himself. But then, these days, it's rare to find such masters. And without such a quality, a scholar who doesn't practice, although may give teachings, but won't have a great benefit in the long run. So it's always good to have, qualified teachers, and qualified teachers who are able to set a very fine example of examples of great practices, such that students or the disciples are inspired by his very lifestyle, subdued and calm, peaceful lifestyle. And now, with regard to teachings, we wouldn't find better teachings than the Buddha himself and Jangu Lama Tsongkhapa and some other masters. Although he spent most of his time in intensive practice, it's amazing that Jenpo Lama Tsongkhapa has produced 18 excellent volumes which have become highest authorities on various aspects of the Mahayana teaching. Many excellent masters or great scholars have said, if we were to weigh in two scales, the teachings of or writings of Jenpo Lama Tsongkhapa and Buddha's own teaching, so they, we won't find any difference in terms of weight, which means there's no difference in terms of quality and authority of the teachings of the two great masters. So this great master has said that we undoubtedly are human beings in appearance, but our vision is very short and limited, in that we only think of the happiness and welfare of this life by totally wasting our life in pursuing worldly things, and we don't seem to think of future happiness and attainment of liberation and enlightenment, and which is exactly the way of thinking of the lesser creatures. Therefore, he has concluded that if we do not think in terms of happiness of future life and liberation enlightenment, so we are not different from the lesser creatures. It's worth giving some thought to what he has said. Are we really behaving mentally like the lesser creatures, or are we different? We have to think about it. And one of the ways of correcting this mistake is to give greater importance to future lives and happiness, different types of happiness of future life. Now, today, we will meditate on Ajahn Chöbkhisen, the precious mind of enlightenment, or the altruistic mind of enlightenment, and I have taught all the methods which are the six courses which help one develop this precious mind, which culminates, if one practices, then culminate in the development of bodhicitta, and bodhicitta being the best object of meditation and the best thing to practice. So we should practice that in this meditation class. The great master Aditya, before he went to Indonesia and Java to receive instructions, further instructions on the development of bodhicitta from Acharya Lamasilingpa or Acharya Swamidev, he had received, in fact, teachings on bodhicitta from Lama Jamben Nanchu, which is Major Yoga and Dhamma Rakshita, And he had developed some degree of bodhicitta, yet he was not satisfied with the degree of bodhicitta he had developed. He wanted more instructions, or rather complete instructions, to develop bodhicitta completely. Therefore, he went to from India to Java or Indonesia, sailing on the high seas for 10 months. And from this we would understand the importance of bodhicitta, and bodhicitta as being the life tree of mind practices, or the very foundation of all mind practices. When he got there in Indonesia, it's not that he's got instructions for a few months and then went back straight to India. After he had got all the instructions, he spent as many as 12 years with Ajahn Som Dev, and until he got perfected in his bodhicitta, he didn't go back. No. When they lived together in Indonesia, Indonesia, it was not that they slept in different rooms. Day in and day out, they were together, so much so that they would sleep in the same room with the pillows, nearby each other, and thus, even have teachings late night. After he had given and made Adisha to practice all the instructions he had given to him, so he further gave as a final gift, a parting gift, an excellent statue of a Buddha, and asked Adisha to go to north, to the snowy land of Tibet, and to help people there. Therefore, it's very fortunate that we get chance to listen to the teachings of bodhicitta without any, without having to face a lot of difficulties. Adisha, as you know, by this time had 155 gurus, but whenever he had to say the name of his master from Indonesia, Lama Silimpa, so voluntarily, he would be seen shaking and tears welling up in his eyes, and then with great reverence and respect, he would say the name of his master. When questioned why he behaved in that way, then he said, "It's not that I have there's a difference in my faith in my gurus. It's simply that I have a small degree, or you can say an iota of bodhicitta, and I've got that small degree of bodhicitta from that master, and therefore this happens involuntarily with me." We have also listened to the teachings of the benefits that we will enjoy if we develop bodhicitta, and the benefits are mentioned in the first chapter of Junju, engaging in the Bodhisattva's way of life teachings that we receive on Monday nights, and I've explained some of the benefits, and from there you would know how precious is this month. There are two ways or two methods of developing bodhicitta. The six calls, one effective method, which we have already done, and the second one is equalizing and exchanging self for others. So that's between these two. The first method is a method which was taught by the Kadamba masters. According to their practice, it was taught publicly, or we can say it was taught to a huge gathering of disciples. It was an open teaching, whereas the second method of equalizing and exchanging self for others is a method which was only taught to very selected few disciples. The tradition was preserved. The tradition of giving the second method of teachings only to very few disciples, or only to those disciples the masters thought they would be capable of receiving the teachings without any misgivings. Until Geshe Chagawa teachings were given in great secrecy, and it was Geshe Chagawa who thought it would be pity to hide this teaching from the general audience or the public disciples when this teaching is of a great benefit. Therefore, he made this teaching public by way of writing the 7-point mount training text, and it was because of this master that the teaching became, the second method became, you know, quite open. Geshe Chagawa received the teachings, all his teachings from his root guru or master Geshe Sharawa, and after receiving the teachings, he spent all his time at the cemeteries or at the cremation grounds to meditate on bodhicitta. Therefore, he was called Chagawa. Chagawa means the one who lived at the cemetery of the cremation grounds. And he spent 14 long years at the various cremation grounds or cemeteries, and thus he was quite successful in developing the exact bodhicitta. Because he developed bodhicitta completely. He said that now I have no regret, even if I were to die today. So that's, a great success. We should also, do something like that, such that even if we were to die today, we have no fear or no regret at all. So that's a sign of a true practitioner. That's what Gautama Master said. So we should try our best, such that when we die, so we have no regret at all for not having done something. Dzogchen Padre Rinpoche, an eminent Nyingmapa master, said the following. I don't care even if I were to die today, because that is a samsaric phenomenon, and it's natural that people die in the world. And if I won't be happy even if I were to live for 100 years, because 100 years would be gone in no time. Whether I live or whether I die, there's no point in worldly activities at all. I would be only satisfied if I could accomplish future happiness and by any means. Now, please practice or this meditation on Bodhicitta. Here again, the mind, our mind itself has to become Bodhicitta or mind of enlightenment. Not that the mind of enlightenment is before you and you try to look at, observe or focus your mind on that, and it's not that. Just as when you become angry, then there's no difference between your mind and anger. Anger itself is your mind, or like when you become passionate, or when there's desire or attachment for something, then there's no difference between attachment and your mind. Attachment or your mind has become attachment. Similarly, when we meditate on bodhicitta, it's not that bodhicitta and your mind are to be separate and entities with separate minds, but your mind has to become bodhicitta itself. Now please begin this. The mantras that we have just said are the mantras which Yavato Jajan, which means the victorious Savajadara, the Tantric Buddha, has blessed with immense power. Because of that, it is recorded in the scriptures that let alone humans who say these mantras with great faith and devotion to the victorious Vajratara. Even if animals, dying animals, happen to hear these mantras, it is said that they will have a happy rebirth in their next lifetime. Now, we really need spiritual values to enrich our lives. Without spiritual values or the teachings, even if we have a huge amount of wealth and we are very wealthy, our lives are in fact not worth living.
No,
They are in the southern continent, as opposed to southern continent beings or humans. In the northern continent, they live a very happy, luxurious life. Humans there really enjoy the maximum or the highest sense of material prosperity. It's because of this, Chandradeva has prayed that may the poor, hungry goats or the paradise be reborn in the northern continent to enjoy material prosperity. Because of immense material prosperity there, people really have no sense of possessiveness in that they don't say it's mine or it's yours. Everything is a common property, yet there's abundance of everything there. Like the material prosperity, they also have a definite lifespan in that they live their lives fully to enjoy that material prosperity without experiencing, without having to face immature or untimely death. Whereas humans in the southern continent, although they have an average lifespan, but it's very uncertain as to when, as to whether humans will live their lives fully. But in the but the northern continent, it's said that humans live 1,000 years. Despite this material prosperity and a happy long life indeed, but their lives are completely without teachings and practices. Teachings, practices, which are the indispensable causes for happy future rebirth, and as a result, they spend all goodness, merits they had collected from the past lifetime, in enjoying such great material prosperity and happy long life, and as a result, they use up all their resources, and by the time they are dead, they are completely without any resources and sort of spiritual practices to fall back on for a happy rebirth. As a result, consequently, they fall into the miserable lawrence. If wealth is everything in the world, if wealth is everything in life after life, then we may as well pray that we be reborn in the northern continent. But if you know that wealth is not everything, wealth doesn't pay in the long run for one's ultimate lasting happiness, therefore we in the southern continent have the access to the teachings, and we give greater importance to spiritual values and their practices. Wealth, material prosperity is not everything in the world. And because they live, the reason why they are called the unpleasant world, unpleasant sounds world. When their death is at hand, a week before, they hear a voice from heaven which pronounces their death. And the moment they hear their death, the ensuing death, then they undergo happiness and psychological suffering and torment. That's why they are called unpleasant sound, not incontinent. Then in the west we have the western continent where humans live 500 years, and although they are not as materially prosperous as their counterparts in the northern continent, but as compared to ourselves, they are very rich indeed. Beings in the eastern continent, or human beings in the eastern continent, they live half the lives of the beings in the western continent to 50 years, and they live that year their lives fully, and again, they are much more prosperous than us in the southern continent. But these wealthy human beings in the three continents who live very long, their lives are completely without the touch of spiritual teachings and spiritual values. Therefore, if we are reborn as humans in one of these two continents, so although we are humans, we would have been, our lives would have been imperfect human life. Our lives would not be precious human life that we have now. It's because of this complete unavailability of teachings there, Bodhisattvas never pray that they be reborn in these three continents. Of the four continents, the southern continent is the poorest and the worst and the most unpleasant place to live, because the gap between the have and have not is very wide. And besides that, then there are many other sufferings, sicknesses, and so on. And their lifespan is also very short. When Buddha Shakyamuni appeared in the world, the average lifespan was 100 years. And in fact, the lifespan of human beings in the southern continent is indefinite. There was a time when humans lived. There was a time when humans lived incredibly long, like hundreds of thousands of years, and their lifespan kept on decreasing as humans became more and more corrupt and degenerated. And therefore, since Buddha's appearance in the world some 2,500 years ago, humans have become more corrupt than sufferings and unpleasant things that which are in the human world, in the southern continent, are in a way great advantages for the humans, for the developed human beings of the southern continent, because sufferings and misfortunes and all unhappy things, they act as impetus, things of impetus for humans to realize that their lives are not that happy. Therefore, this disease make them develop a longing and a yearning for total liberation or freedom from their sufferings, not in one lifetime, but totally free from this suffering for altogether. And because of that, even bodhisattvas living in the blissful pure land, or the Supravati pure land, they pray that may they be reborn in the suffering ridden southern continent, because humans in southern continent are fully capable of attaining enlightenment if they want, even in one lifetime. If any sentient being, or if any living being, who initially as an ordinary being, achieves the state of enlightenment in one lifetime, without prior attainment of some spiritual ground, so that that being has to be a human being of the southern continent, because human beings of southern continent who are born from wombs and who have the six elements which compose their body and or their life, so these six elements have a lot to do with the spiritual growth and finally culminating in enlightenment. It's because of this, many masters have said in the past, like Jamgyur Lama Tsongkhapa of Tibet, that this human life is much more precious than otherwise the precious wish-fulfilling jewels. And only a few days back we learned from Bodhicitta Avatar, or the text called Engaging in the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, that this human life is extremely rare to find because of their values and capabilities this human life is endowed with. Because our human life is quite capable of achieving enlightenment in one lifetime to practicing the spiritual teachings. Because of that, it's said this human life is extremely precious, and because of that, it's very rare indeed to find, unless its proper causes have been created, this human life would not come out of the blue. And in view of this, we have to give greatest importance to the spiritual values and apply this life to as far as we can to practicing them.
It just matches in
Now this ion is called the Brett ion. It's because this ion is a Brett eliminated by the teachings of Buddhas, the past four Buddhas, as well as the following 996 Buddhas yet to come in this Brett ion. However, there are eons, called the dark eons. When this in this southern continent, dark eons would be much more longer than the bright eons. During the dark eons, it doesn't mean that the environment would be dark. It would be dark because teachings, the Buddhas would never manifest, and thus no teachings, no enlightening teachings for the people. People always indulge in the world in negative things. Thus, their lives are suffer darkened by these negative activities. Now, although this eon is a bright eon, and we are passing through the doctrine of the Buddha Shakyamuni, and Buddha Shakyamuni's doctrine of the teachings is also, towards the end of the phase, and towards the end of the phase, and after the end of Buddha Shakyamuni's teaching, until the beginning of to the beginning of the teaching of the next Buddha, the fifth Buddha, it is said that there would be a gap of as many as 4,900 million human years.
No.
Padamba Sangha was an Indian master, or highly accomplished Indian Buddhist master, who visited Tibet, a southern part of Tibet called Dingri, and there he gave many pieces of advice to the lay people that they should wake up and be aware of the teachings available. And he said that the teachings of the Buddha are like a short spell of the sun, rays of sun, which filters through the crack of a cloud, or thickly overcast a sky. And the Buddha's teaching is as rare as that. That because of that, he said that they should take advantage of the teachings. So these are the reasons why spiritual values or the teachings are the only means which will totally put end to all human sufferings of age, of birth, aging, sickness, and death. So, endless birth, endless aging, endless sickness, endless rebirth. So, it's only the teachings which practice and apply thoroughly, which can totally put an end to the cycle of rebirth, and thus a cycle of aging, sickness, and death. Now, for this morning's practice of meditation. We will practice meditation on Bodhicitta. Now, here, you will think about or reflect on the on the disadvantages and the faults of selfishness or self-cherishing thought, and I've explained various faults of self-cherishing thought, and see how self-cherishing thought, selfishness, and the actions performed out of selfishness is at the root of all our misfortunes and sufferings and unpleasant things, and yet see how selfishness has camouflaged as being something close to us and has taken has resided deep inside our heart. And then next thing about the advantages of the thought of cherishing others and caring for others, and how all our human goodness from ordinary goodness to the goodness of enlightenment, how every such every goodness stems or comes from the thought of cherishing others. So I have explained all various possible points about these. So please think about these. Think about them in this meditation class. Now, it seems I have talked a lot about different things, and I have talked about different things such that there isn't much left, and it's all up to the listeners what I have talked about, and to pay heed to them and to practice. However, Nagarjuna has said that if one in the world wants to achieve the state of enlightenment, meaning if oneself and wealthy people want to achieve the state of enlightenment, the root of the state of enlightenment will grow out of the root of Bodhicitta. Father Nagarjuna has said, if anyone was to contemplate or think about Bodhicitta even for a minute or even for an instant, the merits, good fortune that the person gathers is enormous, that even the victorious one, meaning the Buddha, would not be able to calculate. On his part, Nagarjuna, during the latter part of his life, so he gave away his hat to someone who he met on the way and, you know, asked for that. Therefore, what we really need to do is we need to give importance to the practice of spiritual teachings or values, because it's ultimately the spiritual teachings and their practice which count, and not what we do for the sake of this life, and so all the worldly things that we do for the sustenance of this life, these aren't going to pay in the long run. And however rich a person may be, all that he is going to do every day is to eat enough food that is that his or her stomach can, you know, cope with. And it's not that the rich keeps on eating and eating. Even if it were to happen, then it would only cause pain and, you know, cause the death of the person. What it means that however wealthy, affluent person may be, he isn't going to eat more than his stomach or her stomach can cope with. And the poor, however poor they may be, still they have for us food to eat and their stomach to fill. And the same thing, the wealthy may have many clothes, but then they are not going to wear more than one set of clothes. And if they were to wear all they have, then it would become a burden for them. And the poor, although they don't have much, they also appear in one set of clothes. So the rich and the poor appear in the same set of clothes. So that's how all the teachers starting from Buddha down to our present gurus have stressed that it's not worldly material riches that pay us in the long run, or that really come to our help. It's only transformation of our minds or our hearts through the teachings, and thus performance of virtuous actions which are going to stand by us in difficult times. And people really give the greatest importance to wealth, status, and so on, and they keep on amassing wealth. Until death, and by the time they are dead, they will have accumulated or amassed huge amount of wealth which they couldn't use because they were dead, and as a result they get attached to those wealth, and so much because they get attached at the point of death to wealth they have painstakingly accumulated, then they aren't able to get a proper next rebirth. They get they are reborn as a spirit, a haunting spirit, and they keep on haunting the houses, and to the point of really disturbing the peace of the new occupants of the houses.
Mm-hmm. 아니 자네 내 자발 패그래 아 정말 너무 가만히 또 나는 이해는 뜯어요 이 세상 사람이 땅이 빼기 예지라서 뭐 서로 만난 게 여한이 이제 미시로 먹어버려 그래서 지시로 말이 이게 그만 다이 니 내지하고 니 내지 손절에 그냥 그만해 손절 빼기래 그냥 막 걸어서 지금 내 누구 말이 또 손절 자네 가 먹어도 없고 단단한 양 내려줘서 뭐 내가 내 그죠 이제 아 주는 거 근데 사람 계속 가면서 세노서 세노서 매요 사실 근데 저와 이제 저와 그가
To able to meet with teachings and then be really able to practice teachings, a person really needs a backing or the support of merits collected from the past by way of our acquaintance with the teachings in the former lifetimes. Otherwise, however intelligent and you know wealthy and resourceful one a person may be, these are not going to without merits and good fortune as a background from the former lifetimes by way of acquaintance with the teachings. Intelligent and resourceful people in this world are not going to meet with the precious teachings, and the examples are many, as you know, and we can understand this even when Buddha's own time, Buddha did not appear in the world as an ordinary person. Although he came as a human in the world, but an extraordinary human with the marks of greatness of being, like a crown patrician and many physical marks to signify that he was not an ordinary person, a very extraordinary teacher to lead people along the path of enlightenment. But not all were able to meet with Buddha, and Buddha, not all appreciated Buddha's teaching. And so much so that even Buddha's own blood relation, Devdatta, was always critical of Buddha's good actions, positive actions, and as a result, he kept on competing with the Buddha out of malice and ill will, and as a result of that, he died a very unfortunate death, and it's still said that he is in the hellish existence. From this we gather, we understand that to be able to meet with the teachings and then be able to practice as best as one can, one really needs to have strong support and backing of good fortunes from the previous lifetimes. Right now, what we are doing is a good thing because this will again help us in the future lifetimes and then improve upon on the present situation. And if there might be teachers, enlightened teachers available, but if conditions, if certain prerogatives are not fulfilled from one's own side, mere presence of enlightened beings won't help one. The great Indian pundit Acharya Ashva Ghosh has said, Buddhas should have fulfilled the external conditions to save sentient beings, but the sentient beings have not fulfilled internal conditions to be saved by the Buddhas. Therefore, the ordinary childish beings suffer because of their failure to fulfill the remaining conditions to be liberated and to be enlightened by the Buddhas. And it's quite true because on the part of Buddhas have fully developed all the skills of mind, of resourcefulness and wisdom, and are ever ready and waiting constantly to help beings. But because it is utterly impossible in the nature of things, if beings do not fulfill their own conditions from their side, then Buddhas, although they may have all the conditions, resource and wisdom to help, it's impossible to help sentient beings. And it's because we have not turned towards the Buddha in the first place. And even if we did turn, then we got slapped in between, and we, you know, thus we have failed to develop the necessary condition to be helped by the Buddhas. The state of enlightenment has to be evolved over a long period of time, and every good action that we do is going to pay, going to pay, and it's going to work towards the fulfillment of that complete evolution or complete enlightenment, such that when we listen to the teachings for an hour, and let alone saying the mantras, even if we hear the mantras, these are going to pay in the long run. Although we may not understand the, you know, the power of these actions of hearing mantras and listening to the hearing the teachings, but they work towards, they keep on working towards the, our enlightenment. So, a recent great master, Gyalpo Pabungpa, said, most people, you know, seem to be quite intelligent, smart, resourceful, but they are, you know, ignorant. They are fools, so they are intelligent fools, smart fools, because although they seem to be very smart in the worldly things, in getting their worldly ends achieved by way of being very smart and resourceful, but they are like fools who are attached to the childish game and play like worldly activities, just as children. And when they get engrossed in the play, so nothing is more important than their play or their game. Similarly, worldly people who seem to be very smart and resourceful, clever, are in fact great fools. And fools will one day be struck by a lot of death, and then they will have an unbearable bad situation, and that's too late then. Now I let practice meditation on bodhicitta, that's the current and the topic, and that we receiving teachings about. And just as Aryadeva has said, normally it's difficult for disciples to meet gurus, and then to meet with the teachings, and for the gurus to meet disciples, and intelligent, hard-working disciples. When in our case, I think we have all the three factors necessary for spiritual growth of, here. Therefore, when we have these, so we should make most of the present situation and, you know, good, at the present good, good opportunity. Now, when we practice meditation on bodhicitta, or when we reflect on that, as I've mentioned a few times earlier, it's not that these two entities of one's mind and bodhicitta. One's mind itself has to be transformed into bodhicitta, just as we are very used to getting angry and feeling attached to things. And when we get so much attached, the mind itself takes the nature of attachment. When we are very angry, the mind takes the nature of anger. Similarly, here in the case of bodhicitta meditation, it's not that you visualize bodhicitta right before you, before your mind's eye, and then reflect on that. It's a process of transforming the mind itself into the nature of bodhicitta. First, what you do is generate a strong mind, wishing to achieve the state of enlightenment for the sake of all beings, and then seize that mind and see that while reflecting on that mind, the mind itself becomes that mind, that mind of bodhicitta. So please start meditation on bodhicitta. Generally speaking, different types of miseries and sufferings that all living beings throughout space within samsara experience is because is due to the misfortune of not having met a spiritual guide or spiritual teacher, because they have not met a teacher who shows path to happiness and everlasting happiness. As a result, they are they have remained ignorant of causes of happiness and suffering, and because of that ignorance, they have failed to be positive in their actions of body, speech, and mind, and consequently, they have always been quite negative. For destroyers or arhats, of the lesser vehicle, Shravaka Arahats, and the Pradak Buddha Arahats of the lesser vehicle who have attained the state of liberation or nirvana, but who now reside in the extreme of peace of nirvana only for themselves. Why can't they go ahead towards the state of enlightenment rather than be complacent with their mediocre state of liberation and not move forward to the state of enlightenment? Is again due to the fault or due to the misfortune of not having met Mahayana teachers. Now, the Bodhisattvas who try to achieve enlightenment with great pains or painstakingly collecting merits and necessary merits for over three great periods of countless eons, why can't they achieve enlightenment a bit more easily than having to struggle so hard that for eons and eons is again due to the fault of not having met a tantric teacher who would otherwise have shown parts enlightenment in one lifetime? So, meeting a spiritual master can be a great obstacle, and in fact, is the greatest of all obstacles towards securing eternal happiness or peace. And now, imagine almost all the people in the world, their ultimate objective is to be happy in this life, and beyond this, they can't think of happiness of the future life or well-being of the future life. And the reason why they can't think of happiness beyond this, only work for the happiness of this life, is that they have not met a spiritual master to broaden their outlook and to see beyond the scope of this life. Tukhan Chogyam was a great master, the Tibetan master who became the tutor head or the religious tutor of the Chinese monarch before the communist Chinese at certain time. So he also regards that China in the beginning was non-religious country. As a result, the Chinese, like people now today in the world, were quite busy in the pursuit of well-being or material prosperity of that lifetime, of single lifetime. And they showed their perseverance and diligence, or they put their efforts single pointedly into the pursuit of a material well-being of that lifetime. So it was only later on that teachings prevailed in China with the help of two Indian masters who went to China, called Arhat Magadha and Bharata. So when they went, then the Chinese became, you know, Dharmic or religious people. And prior to their arrival in China, there were only only few who had rich propensities of from the past life, who could think of spiritual values and apply themselves to the pursuit of spiritual realizations. So that's the plot of people at large in this world. You know, they really work so hard in pursuing material prosperity and material happiness, and they are ignorant of the fact that they will have to, be separated, or they will have to leave behind everything that they have painstakingly earned or worked for at the point of death. Just as Acharya Shantideva, the great master, says, so our bodies have accompanied us all up to this point, and since at the time of conception in our mother's wombs, but when we die, so we even have to leave behind our own bodies, which we hold so dear and with which we identify ourselves, and our bodies will be dissected into parts, and we will have to leave behind our bodies. And it goes without saying that we'll have to leave behind our world and other relations. But people in the on the whole don't realize this. They are somewhat possessed by the demon of permanence, and they think that everything will last for a long time, and they'll have plenty of time to enjoy what they have earned. For us in Dunedin, there couldn't be better circumstances and the facilities for the pursuit of teachings and the practice of teachings and and the acts of listening to the teachings. We have the teacher and all the other facilities here, and in the future, it's quite doubtful that we will ever have this kind of facilities here. And the teachings that we are receiving are teachings on the progressive path to enlightenment, or graduated path to enlightenment. And besides that, we are also studying guides to Bodhisattva's way of life, or engaging in the Bodhisattva's ways of life. a text which was held in high esteem and which was very popular among ancient scholars and practitioners. And normally speaking, it's quite amazing that people have chance to listen to these teachings. Normally speaking, if it's even rare to hear the name of the text itself, Bodhicitta Avatara. It somehow happened that we have all the, you know, facilities or conducive factors for teachings and for practice. Normally speaking, these conditions are very hard to come by. Buddhist centers, but not all centers are doing well. They might have teacher, but they don't have someone to interpret for him, and or there might be someone to translate the teachers, but they don't have teachers. Or if they have both, then there's something wrong with somewhere. No centers, very few centers run smoothly. And now that we have all the conditions or prerequisites at our disposal, when we have them, then we must take advantage of and be benefited by them. For the Buddhists, the person, the highest person they can look up to, and or the best person they can emulate, is the Buddha himself. Immediately after the birth of Buddha, his father, the king Suddhodana, went to a sorceress or the soothsayer to predict the future of the newly born son. The soothsayer said that if he stayed at the palace, the prince is going to be a universal monarch, one who would have complete authority over all the four continents. If he became a celibate, a renowned person, he's going to become a great teacher and a spiritual guide of suffering beings. So such a prediction was given right from the beginning. When the time came for Buddha to leave the palace, but it was not easy for him to leave the palace because he was almost captive. He was a captive in a way inside the palace, and that he was first surrounded by his son and his wife and his close relations, and then many other queens that he as the prince, young prince at that time had. And then further, the palace was heavily guarded by you know, soldiers, and there was no way that Buddha could escape. Buddha tried to prevail on his father when father Captain being stubborn in stopping him from becoming a celibate and a renowned person. And Buddha told his father, if he could live immortally, or if he could remain alive forever and not die, then he said he could remain, he could afford to remain in the palace and be a king and so on. But if he were to die, if he had to die, he said, he just cannot afford to, you know, to roll in the luxuries of a rural life and not do something for spiritual happiness. If worldly prosperity and worldly fame and worldly goodness is any is a real sense of goodness, then I'm quite sure Buddha would not renounced, God renounced, and Buddha would have remained in the palace and would have become a king. I've given you many pieces of advice that although for us in our best, attempts to pursue a spiritual life, it would be unrealistic and impractical to completely renounce our life, our worldly life, and then concentrate wholeheartedly on practice, because we have to take into consideration the circumstance and the surrounding that we are living in. However, it will also be wrong to be completely carried away by worldly concerns and not at all think of spiritual values. Therefore, we should try to strike a balance between, between our normal worldly life and a spiritual life. Now, for this morning's meditation practice, we will practice meditation on Dongnen practice of giving and taking, or rather taking and giving. Now that I have already given you instructions about how to engage in this practice of taking on oneself others' misfortune and suffering, and giving of one's goodness, of material goodness, spiritual goodness, and good fortune to others. So first, feel that one is in the center and one is surrounded by all suffering beings throughout space, and they then looking at them, having good choice of look at them, and come to realize that they are not unrelated to me. They have a very close relationship with me, in that they have been my parents or my mothers countless times in the past, in the infinite past. And now, what they would really like is happiness. What really would give good, what really would do good to them is happiness. But they do not know how to be, how to create causes of happiness as a result of the suffering. And what really afflicts them all the time is misfortunes or sufferings, physical and mental suffering. Yet they do not know how to avoid the creation of these causes, because they are incapable of creating causes of happiness and avoiding causes of suffering, of their suffering, through Tonglen practice, and give them my goodness to them. I've already explained to you how to do a visualization of Lenluk, the way we remove other suffering beings' suffering, whatever suffering they have, and taking the sufferings on ourselves. And when they have been freed of their suffering, then we replace the sufferings by giving them whatever goodness in any terms we have. We give them to the suffering to those already free beings. And I've already explained how to do a meditation or visualization of taking and giving already. If you could, it would be better to sit in a or to observe all the meditation, you know, techniques or postures, because if you could observe those techniques or postures, it has a special effect on one's body and the channels, and because it's a special effect on our bodies and channels, it will have special effect on our mind, and meditation can become, you know, quite effective. However, it's at least important to sit upright position, and if you, although you may not be able to maintain cross-legged or Vajra cross-legged position. So maintaining meditation postures as best as you could. Now please do meditation or practice meditation on Tonglen. Nagarjuna's foremost disciple, a great scholar and a practitioner of both Sutra and Tantra, teachings of Sutra and Tantra, he said the following, and I will quote him and explain what he has said. He says the verse, in fact I'm citing this from one of his works, the works called Shigyapa, the 400 stanzas. He said most people are not sublime. The first sentence says, or the first line says, most people are not sublime. And it means, when they are not sublime, it means they are not virtuous or wholesome people, in that they spend most of their lives in pursuing worldly ends in the negative way. Therefore, most of them, you know, most of ordinary persons or most of ordinary people who waste their lives or who indulge all the time in the worldly concerns, from hereafter fall or will go to the three lower realms, and he says there's no doubt about it. So this particular lines or this particular verse is kind of a explanation of Buddha's teaching that if one were to be negative in actions of body, speech, and mind, so these actions of negative actions, because of that, one will be reborn in the miserable existence, a miserable state of existence. Whereas if one were to cultivate positive actions, or rather do or perform positive actions of body, speech, and mind, without having to rely on anybody, one can have certainty that one will have a future, a bright future or happy existence in the future lifetimes. Nagarjuna himself has said, sufferings arise from negativities, and from there, from negativities, also arise all forms of rebirths in the three lower realms. In view of this, we have to try by all means to try to stop indulging or performing these negativities of body, speech, and mind, or wrong actions or non-virtuous actions of body, speech, and mind. Happy existence arises from gala, means from virtues or from positive actions, and the person moves from happy existence to happy existence until the person reaches the state of liberation or enlightenment. Shantideva, whose texts we are studying on Monday nights, in one of the chapters he has said, I should be contemplating day in and day out as to how I can be free from the sufferings of negativities, and I should be contemplating that sufferings arise from negativities and miserable rebirths of the two lower realms from those negativities. I should not be thinking about anything else except reflection on, except thinking about the nature of a law of cause and effect. Although these great masters and practitioners have confirmed that negativities cause suffering and precipitate lives in the two lower realms, rebirths in the two lower realms. However, we are still living in a human world, and we can save ourselves from potential rebirth in the two lower realms or possible rebirth in the two lower realms if we engage in what they call purification practice, and you know, get rid of, purify oneself of all negativities performed in the past, and also determine not to repeat, or rather stop at once performing those negativities, then we would have become, you know, totally clean persons in terms of negativities, and as a result, we would have no fear whatsoever for the three lower ends. Father Nagarjuna, who lived incredibly long, for about 600 years, so he had many disciples at different times. One of Nagarjuna's later disciples was famous Chandrakirti, or the glorious Chandrakirti. He has said, when we are free and when we have all the prerogatives or conducive factors of happiness out at our disposal, if we do not take advantage of them and, you know, really hold ourselves from falling into the miserable rebirth, by performing negativities, if we have fallen into the abyss of the two lower realms, then we would have no freedom at all. We would be completely dependent on the winds of our negativities, and then once fallen into the abyss of the three lower realms, who is going to come to your help? Nobody will come to one's help. For instance, the suffering beings of the three lower realms, like the animals or the predators and the higher beings, the Buddhas who have attained the sphere of perfect enlightenment and who have profuse, overwhelming compassion, although, you know, they have a strong compassion for the suffering beings, but for Buddhas to help sentient beings, it is two ways. You know, it works both ways. So sentient beings have to fulfill certain conditions to be helped, and to make it possible for Buddha's compassion to effective towards for them. And once the result of certain negative actions have come into effect, then it's rather too late to do anything for even enlightened beings, for such people. Next, Jamgul Lama Tsongkhapa, the founder of Yellow Head Sect in Tibet, has said, knowing that The black and white commas follow one inseparably, like the shadow follows one's body wherever it is. May I be given strength and blessing to be quite mindful of my actions and to be conscientious not to perform non-virtuous actions or negative deeds. So these are pieces of advice from great masters for all the names of whose names I've already mentioned. So these, although these works are written out of a great understanding, but these works of great scholarship, but scholarship based on great compassion for us suffering beings. Therefore, it's worth worth listening to what they have said and regarding our state of affairs. And this can be understood from different angles. Although all the people who are alive today in the world, all they want, all this long for is happiness, and all they try to do is they try to remove problems and difficulties from their life. And although they're extremely busy in pursuing happiness and in solving problems or in removing difficulties, but how many of such people have been successful in doing this, and as a result, how many of them are quite genuinely speaking happy? Although people put all their energy and effort in pursuing happiness and removing difficulties, not all of them are really successful. It doesn't mean that their efforts have gone astray or have attempts or vain attempts. It means that there is an unseen force behind them which works in their lives, and that is the force of law of cause and effect that influences their their moods of happiness and misery in the present life. This is all the fault of not having and gained real insight into, or not having gained conviction in the working of law of cause and effect. And whenever, if you are really doing wrong actions, wrong things, after listening to these teachings, although you understand the teachings, then if you really find yourself doing something wrong, it is remind yourself that you have not really gained any insight or conviction into law of cause and effect. And as after knowing that one is still indulging in the same old habits of negative habits, then one should really reprimand oneself and just warn oneself whether one really wants to be miserable in the future lifetimes, and if not, stop, better stop doing negative things. And if you do think about these pieces of advice, these will prove really useful in your life, that will improve the values or the qualities of your life. And when the quality of this life improves in terms of positive actions and positive thoughts and speech, and these values will, these enriched values will improve the prospects of the future lives, and one will always keep on improving further and further. And your practice of coming to the class itself is a great thing, because you are able to say those profound prayers, and not only that, you are able to see some, at least you are able to see the paintings that hang on the walls, and there's one or two statues there. And in seeing those things, sow the seed of liberation, which works in one's favor in the distant future. And these act as causes of liberation or omniscience. Just as if a person has a very precious thing, I suppose a wish fulfilling jewel, if not a very rare and rare thing, a very precious thing that is quite susceptible to theft and robbery, and quite open to these damages, that potential damages caused by thieves and robbers. Similarly, when a person truly applies himself or herself to teachings, to their practice by way of hearing, contemplating and meditating on the teachings, such a person has become a wish-fulfilling jewel of happiness, granting every happiness. Therefore, that person is susceptible, more open to hindrances like a sickness, physical sickness, mental sickness, and other forms of hindrances. Therefore, in order to pacify these hindrances and ward off these hindrances, one of the ways of doing that is to come to the Sunday classes, and say these prayers and mantras, which are very effective in clearing away hindrances, and then not be open to hindrances and to interference. I have seen this myself in India too. Tibetans who really apply themselves to teachings and it's and their practices. Excuse me. So it is they who seem to suffer various misfortunes, rather tragedies, or physical sickness, or often going insane, and then losing control of themselves. But those who are common Tibetans, who are wealthy Tibetans, they seem to be doing extremely well. They have good health and and good material resources, so on. So nothing seems seems to go wrong with them, but it doesn't mean that they are better off in the long run. When you know those people in the beginning started engaging in intensive practice of studying or meditation, they something always went wrong with them, and the moment they stopped doing their practice and started doing some going to the road, going to the road construction, which was one of the jobs available to Tibetans when they first arrived in India, so they they regained their sanity, they regained their health, and they were extremely they did extremely well in ordinary worldly pursuits. There was an American student of mine called Lassie. So I don't know if she or she, so that person, when I first arrived in Dharamsala, and started doing some practice, and the moment that person started doing some practice, or Lassie started doing some practice, difficult to say. Male or female? He fell sick, and he saw him as his junior tutor advised that go back and go back to America. So he went back to America, and he regained his health, and after 6 months stay in America, came back to Dharamsala, and started doing some practices. That the second day of his practice was a problem, and the person that he started falling sick, and so much so that he had to give up his practice altogether and go back to America. And now he's married and has family and has two children. Now seems to be doing extremely well. For people these days have very merit or support from support, or they have very little merit. Because of that, when they try to pursue teachings, they are failures in that they face great hindrances in their practice of teachings. Therefore, one of the ways to get rid of these hindrances is to pray, to one's guru, to one's meditation daily, and also to protectors, religious protectors, to clear away these hindrances. For this morning's meditation practice, we will do Tonglin practice, that's practice of giving and taking, and I've already explained to you how to do visualizations of removing others' suffering and taking on oneself, and giving one's goodness in terms of one's visualizing giving one's body, one's wealth, one's marriage to them. So please do Tonglin practice meditation.
Thank you. sale pe toa ton ton ngar de nam ta min dia de de pe gon de pe de ne gon bi ta bo de ko ni ton de de ani ten de da bo de ani je de ji de ani fon ji ga ni de ne te gon ni ji su ji ga de ani je de ji jom be yom ni che na na su di ga de ani jom be ya ani to to ga su su ji ga de cha na de cha ne ga na su ji de de je mai de ani je ye che te ni de cha ne bi ga gon de And this is all gone, but it's not grown, it's not grown, it's not grown, it's not grown, it's not
grown. Every Sunday when we say the seven limb prayers, and at the end of which we say the mantras of the Buddha and the four surrounding deities, now, in fact, one can regard meditation on the Buddha and the four surrounding deities as one's chief practice. If one doesn't have any special meditation practices, meditation deity practices to take or undertake, because the Buddha is the founder of Buddhism or the Buddhist teachings, and then on his right you can visualize God of compassion or Avalokiteshvara, who is manifestation in the form of a deity of all the compassions of all the Buddhas. And on the left of the Buddha you can visualize Manjushri, the deity of wisdom, who is a manifestation of the collected or embodiment of wisdom of all the Buddhas. And in front of the Buddha you can visualize Vajrapani, who is a manifestation of the power and strength of all the Buddhas put together. And at the back of the Buddha you can visualize the female deity Ayatara, who is manifestation of virtuous activities of all the Buddhas, who is the quickest medium of the blessings of all the Buddhas. Where should we visualize and then meditate on them? We have to visualize at a very convenient and easy place, and that should be in a space before one, at the level of one's forehead, not too high, not too low. Now, in order to do this visualization, we visualize them as seated on a huge, spacious throne raised by eight lines, so the two lines in the four cardinal directions. The true practice is to visualize the Buddha and the surrounding deities, and in effect it is one's guru who appears in the form of Buddha in the center, and it is Avalokiteshvara who is in effect one's guru and who appears as the god of compassion. So all of the deities must be visualized by nature being one's guru, but in appearance coming as those specific deities. So it is a better and a more effective way of visualization. In the center of that throne, then you can visualize Buddha Shakyamuni seated on one face and two hands. His left hand in meditation, holding an alms bowl filled with the nectar, and right hand stretching straight on his knees, and in the form of witness, calling the Mother Earth to witness his enlightenment. The very postures that the Buddha maintains while he sits in meditative postures, these postures themselves reveal profound realizations and profound powers. Holding an alms bowl filled with nectar, and his hand pressing the earth to, calling the Mother Earth to witness his enlightenment. So all this signify his conquest of the four Mayas or four demonic influences. And this shows that he has achieved enlightenment by totally conquesting the four demons, and also signifying that if it took refuge in the Buddha himself, so we would also be able to overcome the demonic influences or impulses that we have. On the right of the Buddha, you can visualize Avalokiteshvara, the deity of compassion. There are different forms of Avalokiteshvara, thousand-armed and thousand-eyed Avalokiteshvara, four-armed and Avalokiteshvara, and two-armed Avalokiteshvara. For the sake of simplicity, we will visualize two-armed Avalokiteshvara, and both hands joined as heart, holding a wish-fulfilling jewel. Visualizing the deities, you should see that the deities are extremely pleased with one, and one also has a very strong desire to be united with the deities, as though one is almost being absorbed by the hook of compassion of the Buddha, also by the radiance of the compassion of the Buddha, and so on. So if one visualizes the deities in this mood or atmosphere, it has the great Indian master, Aditya Dibankar Sri Gana has said, so on his part, he was the highest authority of practice of altruism or bodhicitta, and on the ordinary level, he assumed the role of a great learned Indian pandit or scholar. But in definitive sense, Adisha was emanation of the Lord, the God of infinite light and Tava. He has said on one occasion, our lives are very short, but the duration of our lives is extremely short, but there are countless objects of knowledge. Yet we do not know, now how long we will live in this world. It means that we do not have a definite idea of our remaining lifespan. We have no idea whether we will live for a long time or for a very short time, like one day and so on. We have no idea of our remaining lifespan. Therefore, like the goose, when it's given a mixture of milk and water, then in a short span of time, so it is able to distinguish, separate the milk from the water, and then drink the milk and leave the water behind. Therefore, if we were to try to master everything, every art and every science, there's no time because our life is too short. Therefore, try to master the choicest practice or the choicest thing. And according to, for him, the choices, the best thing was to practice the development of universal altruism, or the wish to achieve, the strong desire to achieve the state of enlightenment for the sake of all beings. There was that, don't waste time, but try hard to develop bodhicitta. And his father said, although you may contemplate hundreds of